Everybody had a good time. Unity, I like to hear about. I hope you done hugged everybody that's been here all this time. Know how much you love them. That's very important for what we've got ahead of us. We've got to get to know everybody and love everybody and join in on the team. We've got our work cut out for us.
Malcolm Tuffins, a councilman from the Upper Mattapony Indian Tribe, and I have the duty of introducing the tribal forum this afternoon. During the lunch break, in the interest of time, we talked to the tribal chiefs and they agreed to waive their little 5-minute speech this afternoon. They covered most everything this morning. I think that we need the time to work in the work sessions and come up with a good and firm proposal on what we're trying to do today and get some more history and more accurate history into the history books for our children. In the audience this morning, I was excited about the conference. It's, in my estimation, it's taken off beyond my wildest dreams. Brought to mind when the first man walked on the moon, he said, one small step for man, one giant step for mankind. I think the Virginia Indians embodied today in this room would take a small step that would turn into a giant step for the Indian community in Virginia if we do our job this afternoon. I'd like to also remind you, Helen, you have strict orders to make sure that everybody fills out the evaluation forms and turns them in today. At this time, we had asked Mrs. Helen Hill to enlighten us on views of times past in Indian education. Mrs. Hill taught at the Sharon Indian School and educated 3 generations of Upper Mattapony Indians, also some Rappahannock Indians, and some Indians from various other groups. She is ill and unable to be here today. We have a very kind gentleman, a friend of Virginia Indians, that has graciously volunteered to take her place today. He knows very much about Indian history, about the early education of Virginia Indians. He was very instrumental in supplying building materials and funding to get Sharon Indian School built. He started, and for some of you who are not aware of it, you hear a lot of people talk about second-class citizens. There was a time in Virginia education that Indians were third-class citizens. When the whites and the blacks were receiving high school education, the Indians in Virginia still received a 7th grade education. This was in effect until schools were integrated. A lot of the people from all the tribes received a tribal population listed on their own statement by each tribe. That is the population that resides in Virginia. Each tribe has many more people that moved Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Ohio, as my family did, as Ray's family did, when children got of age to go to school to obtain better education. Now, I'm not sure if that always worked, because I got a high school education in Philadelphia. My mother was taught by Miss Ellen Hill for 7 years at Sharon Indian School. She was a much smarter person than I am. So, you know, there's a lot to be said about Without any further ado, I'd like to get Mr. James R. Kurtz up here to enlighten us on West Virginia education.
I want to show you my notes. You have the notes that I have. Because I didn't realize that I would have this honor, this privilege today. And while I will speak of the negative aspects of the Indian Opportunities for Education in Virginia that I'm familiar with, I want to wind up with an optimistic note and not just dwell upon the sad past. And it was a sad time, as I think all of you are fully aware of, without my recounting all the things. But as a youngster, when I didn't have any money to buy an automobile, we used to canoe up the York River and the James River and go up into the tributaries and visit with the Native Americans of the various tribes. And that was where, as a boy, I became acquainted and had a wonderful time in doing it. But I was stricken with the fact that here were beautiful people who did not have an opportunity for a decent education. And I remember Mrs. Julia Kyle, what a saint she was at the Pamunkey Reservation. And there was a lady, I think, that gave up ever being enjoying the goodness of wedlock, who just dedicated her life to the children of the Pamunkey Reservation. And Mrs. Hill, of the Mattapanile, the Adamstown Mattapanile, if you will, who did the same thing for years and years, teaching, with no, shall we say, official recognition, not even as much as I'm getting here today to come up in front of you and speak of this. And I would touch upon this fact, that we can just praise the Lord that today, for the first time in my life that I know of, we have a sympathetic ear in Richmond. You have not only the governor who is sympathetic to the problems of the Virginia Indians, but you have men like Hathaway Marks and others, and you now you have that special commission that meet, and I think every month. It's a wonderful thing. To go back to the days when we had, and since most of you are of Indian ancestry here, but for the benefit of those who are not, think of having one school teacher who was a white, dedicated lady who would teach everything from first grade through the seventh grade. And then when the children reached the seventh grade and finished up, there was nothing else for them to do, no place to go. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs had never been petitioned to recognize and assume any attitude of concern for the Indians of Virginia. And I dare say when I speak now of the two schools that we've mentioned, that there were other schools just that are in exactly the same situation. A situation that would make you cry when you stop to think about it. And I remember years ago when we tried to get, or I tried to get some material that would combat some of the allegations of a man in Richmond who established the Bureau of Vital Statistics. I hesitate to call his name, but he's dead and gone. And some of you may remember the man. He was called Dr. Flecker. And I don't know why he was a doctor, unless he was a medical man who couldn't cut the mustard, and he took this job. Anyway, he was beset with the problem of tawing, feathering all of the Indians in Virginia with a racial identity that did not belong to them, and confusing the issue. And some of you will remember the long petition that he got out one time when he put all the Indian family names in all the tribes of Virginia into this thing. And then he included the names of others that he knew had no claim for Indian ancestry, and alleging that these were the people who now call themselves American Indians. And it was my privilege to have made the acquaintance of some of the men in New York. I was always kind of forward, I suppose. But I met Dr. Kenneth Burnett of the High Foundation Bureau of Museum of the American Indian, and he was Dr. George High's right-hand man. He had a key to everything. And he was not only an expert in his hobby that of collecting Indian relics and overseeing them just like George High had, but he was also a medical doctor. And he knew a lot of people of real means. In fact, if there's anyone who knew anybody, had any broader choice of elite social wealthy people in New York, it would be Dr. High. I'd like to know who it was, because his daddy was the partner of John D. Rockefeller, who established the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey. And George High really never had to go to work, although he was a surveyor, but he was immensely interested in preserving these Indian relics. And on touching on that subject, let me mention this too, that wherever you find these relics, and I found a lot of them, they ought to be preserved for posterity. They ought to be placed in a place where the general public will have an opportunity to see them, and not locked up like I have done over the years of 55 or 60 years collecting relics and putting them in my basement or on my third floor or stuffing them in the back of the closet someplace where no one would see them and I forget even where I have them. But I'm glad to say that Jamestown Yorktown Foundation, with the money that from the state of Virginia, will soon have a museum over at the festival grounds at Jamestown, and my collection will be there. And I trust in others who have nice things that will protect the memory, let's say, of your forebears, that these things will be placed where they'll do a lot of good and be preserved for posterity. Getting back to the school situation, it was a sad day to see this, and I guess maybe I've been a little more sensitive than I should have been. But Aubrey Stewart was a youngster that I just was fascinated with. His daddy was Chickahominy, Buck Stewart, so some of you older people might remember. And his mother was Hattie Stewart, who was from Pamunkey. And they had quite a large family. I think they had 7 children, 5 boys and 2 girls. And that way, Warren, 7 of them. And now, you take Aubrey, when he finished grammar school there at Pamunkey, he was just a youngster. And he had so much aptitude and personality. And yet there was no place for him to go to school. And yet the inconsistency of the state of Virginia in supplying a white teacher to these schools and then alleging that there was something else. And so Dr. Sanko at the University Hospital, up in Richmond, testified to the fact that these people are entitled to be called Indians and should be so classified. And so did Dr. Frank Speck, whom many of you will remember as a great historian and anthropologist. And many other people, like Dr. High and Dr. Kenny Burnett that I mentioned, were attesting to the fact that by any standard at all, they are entitled to be classified as Indian. And yet they were not. But the inconsistency of the state in saying, well, yes, you can have a white school teacher, but you can't come to our schools, and we can't do anything for you. So all of the Indians have had school buildings, and I think most of you know this, you built your own building with whatever resources you had. And it was my privilege to have married the daughter of a man who was a wonderful, wonderful man. His name was Crawford Rogers. He was president of Norfolk Shipbuilding and Roddick Corporation. And a year or two after I had married my first wife, he asked me to come with him right at the outset of the war to help in the reorganization and the building up of a great big shipbuilding operation in the Berkeley plant, Norfolk Shipbuilding and Roddick. And through him, when I saw the situation at Upper Mattapani, they needed to build a building so that the children could have a place to eat some lunch. Now, mind you now, here are children who have to walk anywhere from a half a mile to 5 miles to get to school. No buses. No buses. They come to this one-room little school, and they had no place to eat lunch. So they wanted to build a room, and I talked my father-in-law into giving them the lumber. And so there I got some personal recognition that really belonged to my father-in-law. bless your heart. I never forget that Harry, Molly Adams, Eunice's mother and Ray's grandmother, Ray's grandmother, yeah, said one day in a weak moment, "Jim, I'm going to make you a turkey feather cake." And sure enough, she did her wild turkey feathers, made me a beautiful cake with a bowl, which will also, it's still preserved, will also be in the museum in the James Van Jorktown Foundation. And I urge you to go. And I understand it won't be built for a couple more years, but let's look forward to the day when it is. And I think it's just wonderful to see that now that you have the opportunities, and I hope that you will continue and go on to college. Let me just get back to Aubrey a minute. I took Aubrey with me, Aubrey Stewart, when he was about 10 or 11 years old. He was finishing up in the little Pamunkey school. And here was a boy with 100% personality, bright as a dollar. And I had met him a year or two before when we camped on the mound down there, Pamunkey, on the reservation near the railroad tracks. Most of you know right where that is. And I took him off on a trip with me to Cherokee, because I knew there was a federal school where they had a boarding school for children who could go to school beyond the seventh and go through high school. So Aubrey went with me. We talked to the superintendent of the school, who said, "Well, now I can't do anything about it. He's from Virginia." So then I had a friend who was connected with the Social Security Department in Washington at the time, a man who used to be connected with firm that I was with before I went to the shipyard. And he knew the founders. He was in there with the founding of the Institution of Socialism and Security, I mean Social Security. And and he knew some of it is getting, it's neither social nor secure. Now anyway, he knew some people in the BIA. And so the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, sent two representatives to the Pamunkey Reservation. We met there. They saw the people on the Pamunkey Reservation. They were satisfied that they were entitled to be classified as American Indians. And so the way was open for Aubrey to go to school. And so Aubrey finished up in school down there. He was captain of the boxing team. He did great. And people just loved him. And the chief today, Robert Youngdy at Cherokee, is also on the boxing team with Aubrey. Today, and I'll make a long story short, he went to Temple University. He served in the Navy during the war. Aubrey worked for us at the shipyard for a while, and then he went on up to, he lives in Lowell, Massachusetts today, and I know he's a tremendous financial success. And I emphasize this for the reason that if you'll just keep looking up and try to further your education as much as you can, and just do the best you can with what opportunities you do have, that you can you'll do just as well as Aubrey Stewart has done. As he told me one time, he said, "Jim," he said, "you know, I was 15 years old before I knew there was any other kind of meat besides muskrat." Now that may be a joke to some of you, but also to some who have lived like that, eating muskrat was almost a, wasn't it, Curtis? Is it a routine, sir? I mean, you ate a lot of muskrat. And coon, and possum, and squirrels. Well, let's encourage that the future is going to be much, much better. And I'm so glad that the Lord has let me live to the sea of tongues, and now Native Americans are being recognized and being treated more decently than they were in the days when I was growing up. And I'd like to close with a passage that would tell us where we might keep our eyes. And I would say, too, that the future is much brighter with a sympathetic ear that you've got in Washington and also in Virginia and up in Richmond. And there is no limit. There is no limit in your future. And I would urge you, in every tribe in Virginia, that you cooperate with one another to the fullest extent, that you band together and help one another in every way possible, and keep your eyes on Jesus. And I would like to read three or four verses here in Proverbs for you. If I can see. Let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck, write them upon the table of thine heart. So shalt thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. So that if we do what you do, whatever you do it in love. You do it keeping your eyes on Jesus, because I know most of you are Christian people, and I mean real Christian people. Keep your eyes on Jesus and look to the Lord for your direction. And I'm sure when you talk this morning about the problems that you have, and now this afternoon you'll formulate a positive program for what you're going to do for the future, I wish you the best in the world. I hope I live to see the day when things will be better than they are now. I thank you for the privilege.
Once again, thanks for all you've done for my tribe personally, Mr. Kurtz. You've heard a lot of people up here speaking today, and I hope you paid attention to all of them. But the next speaker needs everyone's undivided attention, because without knowing what she's going to talk about, it's impossible for us to accomplish what we came here today to do. Our next speaker is from the State Department of Education. She will talk to you on how Virginia decides its curriculum. And Ms. Jane Coots. Your program says June, but that's not correct.
Yes, you can pencil in. I'll switch the letters around in Jean to form Jane, and you'll have that. My answer to Jane, John, Jan, anything. First, let me extend my heartiest appreciation for the invitation to come to this phenomenal gathering. I'm delighted to see the unity that is expressed here. In unity, there is strength. So stick like this, and you will accomplish your objectives, I'm sure. I bring you greetings from Secretary of Education, Dr. Donald Finley, Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. John Davis, the Deputy Superintendent of Curriculum and Instruction, Dr. Ben Howard. Dr. Howerton asked me to represent him today. My level of awareness has certainly been raised about Native American concerns, your problems, the tremendous issues that you face about your history. My level of awareness has been raised and greatly increased. My function with the Department of are some documents that you should write for, which will illuminate how curriculum is decided in the state of Virginia much better than I could have read it. You need to study these documents if you are going to zero in on textbooks in any way. You need to write for the standards of quality in public schools of Virginia. If you just say standards of quality, the person you want to know what you're talking about. The standards of quality take care of basic, minimal standards, both physical and curricular, that all public schools of Virginia must meet. They have to comply with. And there is an administrative review team that comes around to all public schools periodically to check on this compliance. You would address your letter to Dr. Margaret Roberts, Public Information Office, Department of Education, P.O. Box 6Q. Richmond, 23216. Request the standards of quality and the particular area that you need to zero in on, something called standards of learning. In social studies, I would ask for this one. There are standards of learning for all basic curriculum areas. We just finished a mathematics and health adoption. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But the social studies adoption is coming out in 1990 and 1991. We finished that adoption, past adoption, 1985. So we will be gearing up for the 1990-91 adoption. Very soon we'll be working on criteria for selection. So you can't get your words in too early on the next social studies adoption. Write Dr. Margaret Roberts and ask for standards of learning in social studies. These are learning objectives that all public schools in Virginia should attempt and do try to attempt to attain. These learning objectives. In the following subgroups of social studies, civics, governance, geography, American history, world history, economics, and last but not least, Virginia studies. You should zero in on Virginia studies. This particular subgroup of the social studies. Most local divisions offer Virginia studies in grades 4 and usually grades 8. Although there's some local variation in that. Don't quote me on that. Now, Virginia adopted textbooks are evaluated and chosen based upon correlations of what I just told you, the standards of learning. Textbooks are chosen largely with these standards of learning in mind. Textbook adoption occurs biannually, odd number of years, for a period of 6 years, textbooks are adopted. So we just went through math, health, and literature. The official adoption will occur July the 1st this year, and for the 6 succeeding years, textbook publisher contracts will be in effect for those areas. We are gearing up for reading, spelling, handwriting, and science adoption for the next biennium. Social Studies, 1991. Remember that. write to me for the list on Depository Library if you want to do anything. You really need to go and look at the adopted Virginia Studies textbooks. You really need to go and examine the American History textbooks that have been adopted before you write